Welcome to Awaken Calls. Every Saturday, we host conversations with guest speakers from all walks of life. Speakers whose personal journeys awaken and inspire our innate spirit of service. Thank you for coming together to plant seeds for a more compassionate society.
Good day and welcome to the Awaken Call with today's guest, Charlie Halpern. We'd like to get started with all of our calls to practice a moment of silence to get ourselves in the space of listening and presence for our call today. If you join me for 1 minute, I will call our attention shortly. Thank you again for joining. And good morning to everyone. My name is Birju, and I will be your host for our weekly Global Awaken Call. Welcome and thank you again for joining us. As a little bit of context, the purpose of these calls is about sharing stories. And the reason that we're sharing these stories is to offer a little bit of insight as to how leaders in the field of work for the betterment of others, of social good, of social justice, have been invited into that work through their own inner work, through an inner journey that involves their own process of growth. Today's special guest speaker is none other than Charlie Halpern, and he's someone who embodies our theme of cultivating wisdom for justice and social transformation. Along with Charlie, we have a few logistical elements to share. So what I'm going to do is first introduce our moderator, who is Alyssa Martin. She will then engage in a dialogue with Charlie for about an hour. And then at the top of the hour, we're going to shift over into a Q&A, and those who wish to get involved can either do so through a caller queue, which will be audio-oriented, and you can access the caller queue through pressing *6, or you can ask a question online through email, through the email address ask@servicespace.org, that's ask@servicespace.org. I'll again remind us of that opportunity as we get closer to the Q&A segment. Aside from asking questions, if you have reflections based off of the dialogue, feel free to ask that as well. So our moderator today is in some ways an example of the kind of young lawyer that Charlie's work is inspiring. Alyssa Martin is a young lawyer with an interesting mix of legal expertise and inner work. On the former side is her credentials at Harvard Law Review. She has assisted Elizabeth Warren's efforts on Capitol Hill. She's practiced law at internationally renowned Fenwick, and she's been a clerk on the U.S. Court of Appeals. And on the latter side is her background in religious study and a practice of Vipassana meditation. Alyssa, thank you so much for joining us today. I'm curious as to your thoughts on today's theme on wisdom and justice, and I welcome you to lead the conversation.
Thank you so much, Birju, and thank you for allowing me this opportunity to have this conversation with our guest, Charlie Halpern. Thank you, Charlie, for being here. I'm very honored to be here. I just wanted to say a few things on this theme. As Birju mentioned, our theme is cultivating wisdom or developing the inner resources for justice and social transformation. And, you know, our guest today really, really exemplifies this theme as his contributions to education, law, and social movements have been really facilitated by his inner work around wisdom and mindfulness. For me personally, this theme really resonates because it's something I've been struggling with, how to harmonize inner work and outer work in my own life, as I think maybe Charlie will touch upon. There's definitely a temptation to fall into a success trap and to privilege the external over the internal, and that's definitely something I've been tempted by myself. And so it's important, I think, to try and every once in a while at least try to maintain that sort of grounded awareness. And it's really inspiring to see someone who's kind of brought that grounded awareness to their social public life. And so I'm really excited to hear from our speaker today about his experience and insights on that issue of sort of balancing the inner work and social advocacy. Before we get started with the dialogue with Charlie Halpern, I just wanted to say a few things about him and his really remarkable journey, much of which actually Charlie himself has described in his book, Making Waves and Riding the Currents, Activism in the Practice of Wisdom. For those who haven't read it, I highly recommend it. It's an amazing book that really gives incredible insight into his personal journey and the way it's intersected with all of his incredible work in the public sphere. It's a really wonderful book. So just some background on Charlie and his journey. Charlie graduated from Harvard College and Yale Law School and initially worked as a corporate lawyer at a prestigious law firm in Washington, D.C. During the time that he worked at the law firm, Charlie had an opportunity to work on a really important case involving the provision of adequate treatment for mentally ill patients. And the thing about that experience is not only did it have an important social impact, it also was very personally transformative, as Charlie really connected to his client in that case. And that helped spur Charlie to carve out a little bit of a different path for himself, as Charlie and several others started the Center for Law and Social Policy, which was really a first-of-its-kind law firm dedicated to representing the unrepresented public interest in Washington, D.C., as opposed to the more traditional, well-heeled corporate interest. And that was a really novel and risky thing at the time, because it wasn't entirely obvious how a firm like that would be funded. But Charlie and the board found innovative ways to make that venture work, and the law firm ended up achieving a number of really important social victories in the areas of environmental rights, corporate governance, rights of the mentally ill, and a number of other important public areas as well. For example, just to give one example of CLASP's work, their work led to the banning of DDT, which is a really harmful chemical, and their work also led to a lot of increased accountability on corporate boards. Charlie has continued that work, the work of the social entrepreneur, by serving as the founding dean of the City University of New York Law School, or CUNY, which was really a rather unique law school with a public interest mission and curriculum. And as Charlie notes in his book, it was during the time that he served at CUNY, which was personally often quite challenging, that Charlie was exposed to meditation. And hopefully Charlie will get into this a bit more, but for Charlie, meditation really opened up the space for the cultivation of wisdom, which is, as I mentioned, really the heart of this discussion and the theme here. And Charlie has since come to see the practice of wisdom as integral to social advocacy, and it's been a really important part of his work since CUNY and since CLASP. For example, Charlie served as president and CEO of the Nathan Cummings Foundation, where he helped develop a number of grants which integrated support for both social advocacy and meditation and inner work. So, for example, Charlie helped create the Center for Contemplative Mind in Society, which helps lawyers, journalists, and business people develop the tools to approach their work from a place of mindfulness. More recently, just a few more comments on his recent work, Charlie served as the director of the Berkeley Initiative for Mindfulness and Law. So he's inspired many students, like myself, to align their work with their inner values and to develop both their kind of resources of the heart and the head. And Charlie is currently working on how to transform the criminal justice system through mindfulness. And so in that spirit, he's taught mindfulness to prosecutors and has organized a conference with leaders in the criminal justice system on transforming the system through personal transformation. So I'm really excited to be here with Charlie. I'm so grateful to have this conversation. Thank you very much, Charlie, for joining us.
It's really my pleasure, Alyssa. I've been a great admirer of Service Space and its various projects for a long time, and I'm happy to participate in this program.
Wonderful. Well, I thought if it's all right with you, Charlie, I thought we could just kind of start at the beginning. I was hoping for initial part of our conversation, you could speak to some of your earlier years. You After graduating from Harvard undergrad in Yale Law, you clerked for a prominent judge on the D.C. Circuit and worked for several years as a successful corporate lawyer at Arnold & Porter. And I'm curious, what led you to pursue this more conventional or linear path, as you put it in your book, and what led you to kind of turn away from it?
Well, I have to, in responding, let me speak briefly about the earliest years. I grew up in Buffalo, New York, and my father was a lawyer by training, and he was a judge and a law professor for most of his life. So I kind of grew up in a law-saturated environment. And my father was a person who had a great concern, not just with law, but with justice, that the laws should operate fairly. And he brought that into our dining room conversation, and that was a wonderful background for me. I was born, actually, as World War II was just beginning. And as I look back on it, of course, I was too young to really be conscious of what was going on. But in the post-war years, when I was entering a period of consciousness, I became very much interested in the fate of the Jews in Europe. And of course, the enormous destruction of World War II altogether. But growing up in a Jewish household, the systematic and serious effort of the German nation to exterminate the Jewish people had an effect, I think, on how I thought and felt at the deepest level. And as I look back and try to understand the unusual path I took, I have the feeling that this was something that was very important to me and foundational. But it was submerged for many years by my absorption in the traditional academic exercise of hard analytic work and competitive struggle for excellence and achievement. And that was, I would say, the dominant theme in my life in those formative years of high school and college. My time at Yale Law School was moved me more in the direction of social justice concerns. It was very much in the air at that time in the early 60s. The civil rights movement was heating up, and many of my classmates were very active in the civil rights movement, and I was influenced by that. And many of my professors were brilliant and thoughtful participants in that movement. They were writing briefs for the NAACP. They were evolving new theories about the rights of poor people that could be pursued in court. And it was a very heady time for me. So then after my after law school and a clerkship in Washington, D.C., as you said, I went to work in a prestigious corporate law firm, and it was a firm that had a reputation for doing a lot of good work, a lot of pro bono, as it's called in the law world. And I quickly got into that side of the practice, but most of my time was spent doing corporate work and struggling against federal regulation and things of that kind. I did that work for 4 years, and a growing awareness that this really wasn't what I wanted to do with my life. Basically, if you kind of pass through the legal issues, the bottom line was I was helping rich people to get richer. And that just seemed an odd thing to do. And there was this particular firm had a client, which was a big client, that really brought the ethical issues to the foreground for me. And that was the representation of the tobacco industry. This was at a time when the evidence was becoming irrefutable that tobacco was connected to cancer and various other health problems. And our job was basically to make sure that that information did not become the basis for a federal regulation or even a ban on cigarette sales. And that was, I was pretty clear. I didn't want to be involved in that kind of a business for my whole life. And some friends and I started thinking about what kind of an alternative law practice we might set up. And actually, my experience in this big firm and the experience of my colleagues all led to the same idea. This excellent representation that we're giving to corporate interests, what if we were to bring that kind of representation to groups and individuals who lack representation? It might be minorities who are excluded from the communications industry. What if we were to try to help them find a voice there? At that time, this is the late 60s, the field of environmental law had scarcely begun. There were a handful of cases and no lawyers who were really spending full time being environmental lawyers and trying to bring their legal skills to bear in protecting the environment. So we decided we'd give it a try, and we went through a long process, and we got some foundation support for it. We got some leading lawyers with strong establishment credentials to serve as our board of trustees, so that we looked more credible than our age and experience would have suggested. And we went to work.
Thank you, Charlie. That's that's what I find really intriguing about listening to the story, and especially the light you were shedding on the sort of your early years, it sounds like a lot of the sort of the roots for the sort of later changes in your life were sowed at a young age, and with your family's experience and with some of these kind of social changes that were happening when you were younger. And I was wondering if you could speak a little bit more to that, and to the extent to which maybe some of these earlier seeds were planted for some of the work that you would eventually do in terms of cultivating wisdom. Because I know it sounds like some of these earlier seeds were planted for social advocacy. If you could speak to the extent to which some of the seeds were planted for the cultivation of wisdom as well, I think that would also be very interesting.
Good. That's an important matter, because on the surface, I was being groomed in a very rationalistic, intellectual environment, and I distinguished between the cultivation of wisdom and the cultivation of analytic skill and cognitive intelligence. For me, and my early years were definitely on the analytic cognitive side. When I look back and think, well, what was planting the seeds of an impulse to do inner work? A couple of things come to mind. One was my experience in nature. I was a I went to a summer camp in northern Ontario for a number of years, the formative years, my teenage years mostly. And I got into the practice of taking fairly extensive canoe trips from this camp, and I found places of peace and stillness, sitting in the stern of a canoe and paddling across large lakes and portaging the canoes from lake to lake, and being with a group of other teenagers, but also having being on my own and connecting, as Thoreau or Emerson would suggest one can, to depths of inner reflection in the context of beautiful and stirring natural spaces. And that was, I think, one important factor for me. I met the woman who was to become my wife at that summer camp, and we married young, and she has been an absolute partner in everything in my life since I was 20. And the fact that she was interested in social transformation and inner exploration was a great gift to me, and the fact that we did this together over all of these decades has been an incredible gift. In fact, when I'm through with this phone call today, she and I are going to put our canoe on the roof of our car, and we're going off to a nearby lake to spend the rest of the day paddling until it gets dark and we come home.
Wow, that sounds wonderful.
Yeah, this has been a real blessing, and you know, I couldn't have left this comfortable law firm job to kind of take a leap off into space and invent a new kind of institution that the legal world had never seen before, if I didn't have 100% support and buy-in from her. So that was it. There was another thing too. When we started the Center for Law and Social Policy, we thought we were just starting a law firm with different kinds of clients and a different kind of value orientation from a regular law firm. But then it became clear that we had an opportunity to reinvent the way we work together. My colleagues and I, the support staff we hired, the students we brought into our program from the beginning. We always had in the early years at the Center for Law and Social Policy, we always had students coming in. And we had we tried to create a less hierarchical, more engaged, more committed community. We played together as well as working together. We tried to engage each other as whole people and not just as brilliant thinking machines, which is basically the way, as you know, Alyssa, that law schools tend to engage with their students. We were trying to engage with each other as people. And that paid off because many of the students who passed through our program undertook the kinds of public service and public interest social justice law careers that we were trying to do in our program, and they've been creative and innovative in their own right.
So one of the things I'm hearing and that I find really interesting is, you know, it sounds like when you transition from the law firm to CLASS, Center for Law and Social Policy, you know, there was this sense that, okay, this new work is going to be more aligned with my values. You know, I feel this is going to be serving a broader social interest, and so in that sense, it's going to be more meaningful at that level. And then also, you mentioned that it was a novel experience in terms of how you related to people and dealing with people's kind of whole persons. So those are really interesting themes. And I was wondering if you could speak about some of the kind of feelings and emotions you had at CLASP, and whether you were, whether did you feel at that time, okay, wow, now I'm so aligned, now this is exactly right, or did you kind of experience some challenges, or what were the sort of kind of maybe the some of the inner issues that you were dealing with at that time, and if there were any roadblocks that you were experiencing, or areas where you thought that there were opportunities for further inner exploration during that time period?
I would say it was a very satisfying, exciting time in my life. I've got to give you the sense of this. This was a time of radical innovation in the country, with voices of social justice and interconnection and concern for marginalized people was really coming forward. We were deeply engaged in that, and deeply engaged in it in a way which was unique in my experience, and that is that I was in an organization that was really supportive of that kind of work. So we had our ordinary tensions, things, for example, that would push us in the, I'll give an example, something that pushed us in the direction of more involvement. It's not exactly the kind of inner work that I came to value at a later point in my life, but it certainly deepened my understanding of who I was and what kind of doors could be opened. There were four of us who started CLASP, and all of us had in common the fact that we were white men. It's hard to, for perhaps someone of your generation, to really know how that could have happened. It would be so unlikely in America today. But in America in the 1960s, even as the old ways were disappearing, some of them were not, and we ended up with four white men as being our pioneering group. And the first challenge we received was from the group of women who were doing clerical and secretarial work in our organization, because they were all women. And they were women who were talented and who had taken this job because they believed the work that CLASP was doing. That was why they were there. And then they found that to a very disagreeable extent, we were operating the place vis-a-vis them, the lawyers and the support staff, in very much the same hierarchical way that was common to law firms and to the other jobs in more conventional settings that they had held. And they resented that, and they undertook to organize around changing it. First, they wanted to be more involved in our decision-making process, and they thought that we should be doing women's rights law, a very novel field at that time. So we had a series of facilitated meetings, some of which were not as skillfully managed as they might be as I look back on them, but we were all open to moving this process forward. And out of this process came a number of changes in the ways we worked together. They were more involved in our selection of cases. They elected one member of the board of trustees of the organization, that is the support staff did, and we brought in two young women lawyers, recent graduates, to try to develop a women's project. What would a women's law project look like? Because it was quite a novel notion at that time. how could they use the law and the administrative processes of Washington to advance the cause of women's equality. So it was a productive thing, and again, making us go a layer deeper than we had started. the Women's Project that we started then, in, I think it was 1970 or 71, has since grown and become an independent group called the National Women's Law Center, a very prominent player on women's issues in Washington today, and of course one that is deeply challenged and threatened by the changes that we saw this past week in Washington with the new administration. And they are now in the process of organizing to protect the rights that they and others have won for women in the United States and around the world over the last 45 years. As you know, the issues that are currently under debate are not just undoing the Obama legacy, but going back to the New Deal, really, and trying to turn back the clock. Now, so they have their hands full, and all of that, of course, grows out of the work of class. And they don't see the current challenges as reacting to a particular person or a particular administration, but rather continuing effort to pursue and press for the equal treatment of women that has been their cause for all of these years. So that was the kind of deepening we saw in those days. It was really because we were organized with the kind of mandates that we had, and because we were engaging with each other at a deeper level, we were able to see things and take actions that were not apparent to other people who weren't doing this work. And we were doing it in a context where we had a supportive environment, where we were working with people we really cared about, and we were representing causes and people that seemed vitally important to us, environment, the rights of the mentally ill and mentally retarded people, and the rights of women, rights of minorities. All of these things seemed so important to us that we were, I think, touched at a deeper level than many professionals and many people have the good fortune to work at. So we did all of that, and that was kind of where, at that time, my balance was still very much on the outer work side and less on the inner work side. The inner work side became more prominent in later years.
I understand. One thing I found interesting, and maybe you can expound on this a bit more, is it seems like, you know, the inner work did become an important part of your time at CUNY. So I was wondering if you could maybe speak to that a little bit, and how, when that shift started to happen of, yeah, you know, recognizing that, you know, maybe you need some other resources and tools to draw on in, you know, when you're trying to think about social transformation.
Yeah, that, thank you for that, that prod, that reminder. When was it? I did various public interest law things in Washington through the 70s. And in 1980, I was invited to come to New York City to become the first dean of the City University of New York Law School. There had never been a public law school in New York City. Lots of private law schools, but none public. And there had never been in New York City a law school that was specifically aimed at public interest law. So it was a very attractive invitation for me, and I accepted and moved my family to New York City from Washington. But it was an extremely hard job. I knew it was going to be a hard job, but I didn't know just how complicated and difficult it would be. In part because we had such a wonderful and unique and challenging opportunity, which was to rethink the way lawyers are trained and train them in a way which moves them in the direction of public interest law practice. We were doing that in what is, after all, a conservative profession, law, and a conservative corner of that profession, which is the way we educate lawyers. Harvard Law School pioneered the modern model of legal education in the late part of the 19th century, and other law schools have pretty much followed that the case method, the things that you're very familiar with, Alyssa, the case method, the analytic approach, the focus on appellate decisions, the emphasis on making lawyers wonderfully articulate oral advocates, but not very good at listening, not very good at listening deeply even to their own clients.
Mm-hmm.
So we were trying to think of a different way to educate people, but it's hard to reinvent. You know, all the case books are written for the old way, and I didn't realize just how different, how difficult our challenge would be. And we had some very conservative politicians we had to deal with. We had a state legislature, and because we were a public interest lawyer, we decided to admit students on a different basis. We didn't admit them on the basis that you and I were admitted to our elite law schools. We wanted to find people not only who said they were interested in serving the public interest with their professional skill, but we wanted people who had actually shown some commitment and skill in that direction. So we were bringing in a bunch of students. Our first-year students were activists. They had been activists in college, and many of them were older people who had been union organizers and had been environmental organizers, and demonstrators who had been arrested repeatedly for sitting in at nuclear power plants that were under construction. It was the first president of the Black Policemen's Union in New York City was one of our first year students. So it was a very engaged and energetic and disputatious a group of people who came in. And then we hired a faculty. It was also people who had been public interest lawyers, people who had done it in their lives. They were leaders in the women's movement, the civil rights movement. We didn't have any environmental lawyers in our first group. But so between the activist, energized students who came to this place, the activist faculty, and the conservative politicians and the people who were in charge of our budgets. The City University of New York is not actually the most innovative educational institution in the world, so for them to be starting this new law school was a bit of a jar. And we had to be accredited by the American Bar Association. There were elements of the job that I had never imagined, and they weren't easy. They were exhausting. A friend of mine who had started the University of Hawaii Law School as their founding dean, hadn't lasted for more than 2 years, actually, came to see me one day and said, "Look, I know just the kinds of challenges you're facing. I want to suggest to you a simple thing that you might do that might make your life a little bit easier." I said, "Oh, what's that?" And he said, "Well, why don't you try meditation?" And I said to him, "What's that?" And he explained to me very simply, simple terms, described a practice of sitting for 15 or 20 minutes a day, watching the breath. When thoughts arise, you let them go and bring your attention back to the breath and back to your body. Very simple. He said, "Get up 15 minutes early. and do this. I said, well, what good is that going to do me? He said, well, you know, what you might find is that you find a place of stillness and calm that you can, during the course of a busy day, reach back to from time to time. And as your stress level is getting higher, as you're about to blow up at the academic bureaucrat from the city university who's trying to get you to do something that is inconsistent with your plan for the law school, rather than just blow up, smoke coming out of your ears, you can take a few minutes, a few breaths, and come back to a place of stillness and respond with greater wisdom, with greater balance and a sense of being grounded rather than just flying off the handle. So see, it's not going to happen every time. This isn't going to be a miracle cure. But why don't you give it a try? I said, well, we'll see. I went and talked to Susan about it, my wife, and she said, look, why don't you give it a try? This job is driving you crazy. So I did, and it helped. No miracles, but it helped. And the first result was that I was managing my emotions more effectively and being somewhat more effective in my more difficult interactions. Gradually over time, this practice settled in and helped me and showed and suggested a path of combining my commitment to social transformation in the world and doing inner work that would support and sustain that. So that was an important turning point for me. And then while I was dean at the law school and we had graduated our first class, and it was really interesting, having some considerable influence in the world of legal education. A very important teacher came into my life. I was reading the catalog of the Omega Institute in Rhinebeck, New York, up the Hudson River from New York City. And there was a Vietnamese teacher who was relatively new to teaching in the United States, but he was a Zen monk and a poet and an activist. He was doing a meditation retreat at Omega. And I thought, well, you know, I've been doing this meditation on my own, just in the simple way that had been suggested, getting up and meditating every day. I said, well, maybe this would be a way to deepen that practice and see what other riches it could open for me. So Susan and I went to this retreat. It wasn't wholly a silent retreat, but it was, I think they said, like 80% silent. We did all our meals in silence. And we walked in silence through these beautiful wooded rolling hills of upstate New York, beautiful place. And I got to see, to be quite close to Thich Nhat Hanh, who since then has become a very important Buddhist teacher and a teacher of mindfulness practice in around the world. A wonderful man, and I just had never been exposed to that kind of teaching. The teachers I knew were oriented toward passing along content and skills and analytic tools to people. This man spoke simply and wisely, and his presence, the stillness that he embodied, was an inspiration. Could people be like that? I'd actually had another teacher who named Ralph Hsu, who was a research scientist I knew in Washington, but for a scientist, he was of Chinese origin, and an incredibly wise person who had spent his life integrating Asian wisdom and Western science. And, you know, he was just, I knew him as a friend, not a teacher, but he was also, Ralph Hsu was also a great influence on me in those days. So this, and the most striking thing to me about Thich Nhat Hanh was that he was so wise and grounded and kind. And at the same time, he had been a powerful advocate for peace in the depths of the Vietnam War, so that his voice was sufficiently strong that both the Viet Cong and the Americans and their allies all found him very objectionable. And he, with remarkable courage and effectiveness, organized the monks of his order. He was a Zen priest, and also organized in the general population a peace movement in the midst of the chaos and terror of the Vietnam War. And that he could draw on these inner strengths he had to be so effective an advocate was very powerful to me. It just a thought, you know, this is a direction that I could move in. When things get really hard, when we're dealing with environmental crises that have global significance, issues of nuclear power and the use of nuclear weapons in war, or global climate change, things that we really, that are so fundamental to human civilization and to the preservation of the planet. All of these things, one could be absolutely grounded and have a place of stillness and still be able to come forward on these difficult issues in a way that is powerful and resonant for many people and persuasive and effective.
I was wondering if I could follow up on that point, actually. In my extremely limited experience, one of the things I kind of find difficult about sort of balancing the inner work and the outer work, and I'm starting to hear a little bit of this, is that, you know, it seems like the inner work is, it's so difficult. It can be so difficult. And, you know, if you really want to dedicate yourself, so time-consuming to get to that place of mindfulness and grounded awareness, you know, it's, you know, again, in my limited experience, it's like you've never arrived. It's just a continual journey and effort at purification. And, you know, so you want to continue to develop in that way. But then on the other hand, you also want to be kind of out in the world and doing some good and having some impact. And, you know, I'm just kind of curious as to how you've tried to balance that in your own life and, you know, any difficulties you've encountered in terms of, you know, wanting to continue to push inward while also having some sort of impact outward and wanting that to kind of radiate, you know, in a sort of maybe more external way, you know, and how to kind of continue to kind of just balance those two forces and make sure that the inner part isn't being forsaken, because it can be, you know, like I said, in my experience, that can be the real tough part.
Well, that's the puzzle that we, the koan, the conundrum that that we all deal with all the time. You know, in a certain sense, it's easier for a Buddhist monk wearing robes to do that inner work and make it really deep and powerful. than it is for somebody who's living in a family and supporting, you know, sending children to college and having to pay the rent. It's harder. And, you know, the wisest people I know, I've encountered people like Thich Nhat Hanh or the Dalai Lama, are people who wear the robes and do this full time. And I'm never going to have the level of wisdom they do. What I can do is take their inspiration and walk that same path. And I can tell you what I've done, and it's different for each person. There are a few things. One is, first of all, is to make the commitment to start. I'm going to put my feet on this path, and I'm going to walk. And sometimes it'll be really hard. Sometimes it'll be relatively easy. And sometimes it'll seem dry and unproductive. Other times it will provide real aha moments where you have a feeling that I'm seeing things that I hadn't seen before and doing things differently. And then you look back after you've done it for a few years and you say, hey, I've really changed quite a lot. Not as much as I would have liked to, but some, considerable. So daily practice, you know, everyone, as I tell the busy lawyers, everyone can find 10 minutes a day to sit. Start with 10 minutes, then move it up to 20 minutes, maybe to half an hour, and just be faithful about it. And look for places in your daily life in the world where you can bring those moments of silence and reflective insight to bear in the work you're doing. That's one thing. Second thing, there are now places in many parts of the country where you can go on retreat with skilled teachers and caring environments where you sit with a group of people who share your interest in doing the inner work, and there are teachers who have been at it for decades who can help you move along. While our media-soaked environment is one of the things that makes it so important and challenging to do this meditative work, it's also a resource that you can get. You know, you can take out your cell phone and have access to really wonderful teachings that will help move you along the mindfulness path. And you can listen to those talks and discussions online and move your inner work along. And the other thing that I think has been very important to me and would recommend to anyone is to make sure you try not to do this alone. I started on this as an isolated path, but it became much more productive when I had friends and colleagues who were involved in the same enterprise. For example, at this point, I have the good fortune of meeting once a month with a group of lawyers and law professors and former judges. Once a month, we meet with a wonderful teacher, Norman Fisher, who teaches both Zen practice and also Jewish meditation. And we talk about how we are struggling to bring our mindfulness practice to bear in our works in law and social transformation. So I think some kind of community of that sort is extremely important, and at this point, readily accessible. Mindfulness is now, mindfulness and meditation were two terms which made people raise their eyebrows 20 years ago. At this point, There are lots of people who are interested in this, and there are lots of people who are practicing. So that you're not kind of climbing the same steep cultural hill that you were climbing 25 years ago, or that I was climbing 25 years ago. There's some cultural resonance for the work. I don't want to overstate how powerful that resonance is, but you know there are plenty of lawyers doing this work, and there are lawyer sanghas in many cities, and it would be relatively easy to set one up too.
Mm. Alyssa and Charlie, I'd love to jump in here. I'm really appreciating where this direction is going, and it strikes me that we're really moving to the crux of the kinds of questions that our callers would also be intrigued to reflect on, of how they bring this into their own lives. I'd love to take this opportunity to invite the callers into the conversation to the extent that they feel called. We can have two different ways to invite folks in. One is the audio cue. You can press *6 if you have a comment or a question for this conversation. Another option is ask@servicespace.org. That's ask@servicespace.org. And I'll turn it right back over to you, Alyssa.
Great. Thank you so much, Birju. You know, actually, I think one area that might be fruitful to kind of kick into this next conversation, you know, I was wondering if you could speak, Charlie, to how your inner work and how your meditation practice, which grew over the years, changed your approach to social advocacy, and, you know, whether... I think how you're able to kind of deal with some of maybe the more kind of angry and reactionary voices in the sort of social justice field. How is wisdom and the kind of and your cultivation of it shifted your approach in that regard?
Yeah, these are two things that are very live issues for me now. I would say, as I think of the way I try to be active in the social justice world and social transformation world, I try to. This is a work in progress. I try to be more balanced, and when I feel myself being taken over by emotions like anger or fear, to try to come back to the contemplative space and come forward instead of letting my actions be guided as they might have been in the past by fear and anger, instead to try to find a place of more positive feeling, and a place where an affirmative vision and a sense of interconnection with other people could be the motivating forces. There's a big difference between basing an argument, for example, on the use of DDT, which was being used in, which was incredible abandon, without attention to the negative consequences it was having on the total environment, and just to be raging about the pesticide companies who are so indifferent to the state of the world. I don't think working from those kinds of emotions is good for my inner being, and I don't think it's the most effective way to be in the world. I think it's much better if I can put myself in the place of someone who's spent a career working in the pesticide world, thinking that he was doing good things, and think about how to talk to that person in a way that is going to permit conversation, not shouting. So that's one of the things. And it's, and as I say, it's work that I've been working at, and I'm still working at, and I'm not there yet. But I do believe that that is both good for my own inner growth and good for outcomes. When we started doing the DDT work at CLASP, we were then climbing up a very steep hill. Nobody had ever done anything like this, try to get the voice of environmentalists concerned with the health of the planet heard in decision-making processes in Washington. What a radical notion that was. But we tended to think about our opponents as enemies. And if you can kind of dial the heat down so that your opponents are opponents, the people who, for various reasons, the causes and conditions have led them to positions where they're taking these positions. And at that time, Rachel Carson's book, Silent Spring, was a powerful summary of the science at that time about the damage done by DDT. And it was important then if we could have had more forums about Silent Spring and less adversarial proceedings, then I think we would have done the job better. And I think that's true now too. When we're facing real challenges to for me, it's my life's work is being challenged. It's an effort to silence those voices that we brought into the process in those days. And we've got to respond forcefully and effectively and in a way that's grounded, that is not driven by rage, but instead driven by a sense of possibility, a possibility that we can open new dialogues in this country and back off from the intense polarization that's characterized American decision-making processes over vitally important matters for decades at this point. And how can we come together in a place of dialogue, mutual respect, and interconnection? Look, I'm a grandparent, and a lot of these people are grandparents. And if we could have the wisdom of the elders passing back and forth among grandparents, that would be a great achievement. And I think that can only be done by people who have done some inner work, the leadership of that conversational process.
In inviting that spirit of dialogue here, Charlie, I'd love to invite in some of our callers, if that's okay with you.
Great.
Wonderful. We'll move to the first person in the queue.
Hello, Charlie. Can you hear me?
Yes, I can hear you.
Hi. Hello. My name's Mothia. I'm calling in from Devon in England, and I've just listened to your conversation, and it's fascinating. I used to be a lawyer working in a city law firm in England, London, and a few years ago, around the Occupy movement, I had a huge shift in my own way of looking at the world and how community can be inspired by a longing that is driving all of us. And I went on a kind of a journey myself, and I've come to this place of similar maybe to the place where you were 20, 30 years ago. But what I respect and what I've heard from you is how you actually have achieved so much real change in creating the organizations and the structures for changing the law from I see a movement almost from social justice towards an environmental movement, which around Carson's time, around Silent Spring, that time. And now we're entering this kind of new phase, it feels to me, of how do we move to the ecological way of looking at the world? And that's what I've been really focusing on. Joanna Macy's work has been really key to me around her Buddhism practice, and she often talks about this active hope of having to change. I'm really connected to what you spoke about at the end there, about how we can use meditative practices and so on, which I do, which I've been bringing in to myself. And a friend of mine has started a magazine called The Conscious Lawyer to kind of bring all these different people together who are working different ways on collaborative law and integrative law, eco-law. But yet it hasn't really at the moment grounded itself into working organizations that can actually create the change that I think you helped create around, you know, with your organizations. And I guess my question is, what I'm sensing also is through Joanna Macy's work, and I've been studying at a place called Schumacher College in Devon, which is all about holistic Gaia theory, James Lovelock's work, all around that we're in a living system, that the earth is a living system of which we are part. And so there's a lot of movement around spiritual ecology and sacred, what you could call sacred activism, which kind of brings both the meditative practice towards meaning of our human life within the greater Gaia ecology. And so I'm just trying to say, is there space for a move from just meditative practice to spiritual ecologist lawyers or sacred activist lawyers? And how can we make it real in the way that you made in the 60s your movement real?
Well, thank you for that question. Is your name Mafia?
Mafia, yes, thank you.
Thank you for those questions. And I think, well, two things. One lesson I've learned is it's very important to take people where they are and move them along at the pace that they're ready for. It's the only way to succeed. And I can remember how skeptical I would have been of these initiatives if they were put to me when I wasn't ready to hear it. So I think that kind of sensitivity is essential. Many people, when I started doing this work, we set up a thing called the Center for Contemplative Mind and Society to try to bring contemplative practices into various sectors of the secular community. And people used to say, well, law is the hardest place to go with that. You really, you know, that's a real tough nut to crack. And I think it's also a very important one. You know, you have lawyers thinking this way, and it can have huge changes. Don't misunderstand me. The legal profession has a long way to go. But let me give you an illustration of both these two points. Mm. One was we've been working with a group of prosecutors in San Jose, a city near the Bay Area. And people would say, if lawyers are hard to introduce to mindfulness and inner work, then among the lawyers, it's the prosecutors who are going to be the hardest. And we've been at this with these folks for about a year. And I thought from the beginning they were surprisingly receptive. They were people who were struggling in their work. They wanted to do the best job they could. They were very devoted to the work they do and finding redress for victims of crime, things of that kind. But they also had a kind of a tunnel vision. By trying to use their language to talk to them with respect for the work they're doing, we've had, I think, some significant movement. But I wouldn't say breakthrough, but there's been significant movement. And the idea of what a mindful courtroom could look like if the prosecutors, the defense counsel, the judges, And all of the personnel around the courthouse, including the police officers and the prison guards, if they were all had some grounding in mindfulness, is it possible to imagine over time some significant change, a different kind of criminal justice system that was grounded in rehabilitation and empathy and a sense of community and shared purpose? So all I can say is stick with it. I think I know the magazine, The Conscious Lawyer, and it's the new one. You mean out of Ireland?
That's right. Yeah, Elaine. Yeah.
That's wonderful. Yeah. It's wonderful. And I'm hoping to write something for them.
Brilliant. Yeah. Great.
But I think it's very important that this be an international movement. I'm sure you know about the Mindfulness Committee in Parliament, or do you?
I've heard of it, yeah, one of the select committees in Parliament in England, yeah.
Well, it's fantastic. There are 150 members of Parliament who've been through the basic training in mindfulness.
It's
a wonderful program. And the former MP who headed that, Chris Ruan, is now carrying that work to the parliaments of other countries around the world. So that's an encouraging sign. I sat in on a hearing about criminal justice and inner work in at Parliament 18 months ago, and it was very inspiring to see all the people who are working in provincial detention centers and in prisons with prisoners and to increasingly with prison guards and correctional officers, and that's a big deal. So we should be working together and sharing our experiences and encouraging things. Thank you.
Can I be able to ask a supplementary question? Oh, I think you need to move on, will you? Now.
If we can come back to you at the end if there's time, I'd love to go on to a couple more questions. But thank you so much for asking, Mafia.
Yeah, thank you.
Of course. So I'd like to invite a question that came in online. This question is from Priyanka in Bombay. She says, Charles, thank you so much for the gift of your being. A lot of what you say resonates well with me as I pursue justice in my work as a journalist reporting on issues of human rights. My question to you is, how does one keep compassion and hope alive when cynicism seems easier, especially in the pursuit of justice? I see many, many passionate advocates of justice who sometimes are unable to see any light at all. On a similar note, how can we have political conversations that anger us without projecting it onto others when we are so doggedly pursuing justice?
Let's see now. Thank you, Priyanka, for your kind words. I had a conversation. I was teaching a workshop at the University of Hawaii in law school. About mindfulness, and there was a student there who was a third-year student. She had come to law school specifically to work on environmental matters, and she had, as a student, she had worked on two or three major cases that had huge consequences for the Hawaiian environment, and she had lost them all. And what I said to her was that mindfulness was a good skill to cultivate, especially for public interest lawyers who are deeply devoted to causes that seem so urgent. Because it's inevitable in your work, you're going to lose a lot of cases. And you've got to have something to fall back on, which gives you a framework in which to hold these losses and to hold your disappointments and stick with it. And which invites you to take a longer view of things, to see, you know, not just the immediate matters that you're handling, but to think about the long history that's led up to the environmental mess we're in, and think about and to recognize that the power of private interests and materialistic impulses is tremendous in this area and deeply threatening to the integrity of the ecological system. And then think about the progress that we've made and how our efforts can help in dealing with these incredible challenges. As you know, in this country, we're now facing the reality that our new president is deeply indebted to the fossil fuel industry and speaks of the possibility of nuclear war as if it's an acceptable policy option. So those of us who have been working at these issues for a long time have reason to be deeply saddened. And we need a way to maintain our sense of hope and possibility. And I think that involves developing inner strength, which will help us to deal with these things and help us to put aside the cynicism that we feel inside ourselves and which so much in our society encourages. Mm. And as for the problem of what we do with our anger and how we avoid just spraying it around on people we view as adversaries and even on our friends and even on our family. You know, if we don't have a way of processing our anger, we're going to spill it over on a lot of people with a lot of destructive consequences. There's no, and I haven't found any easy way to deal with that. I do find my mindfulness practice gives me sometimes the capacity to just breathe with the anger and to let it go. And the more I do with that, the better I am at it. And I'm only fairly good at present. I've only been at it for a few decades.
That's the thing. It's the easier said than done element that the practice really helps with. Thank you so much, Priyanka, for the question and Charlie for the response. I'd like to move to the next question, which is from Christy in Sherman Oaks. She asks, can you give an example of a story of a time when you saw mindfulness cause a drastic change in the climate of the conversation with someone who did not practice your same techniques?
Well, the easiest, what's relatively easy is to retain your mindful center in conversation or in conflict with somebody who's also has the same commitment that you do. Even if there are major substantive disagreements, that's pretty easy. The hard one is when people are coming at you full of anger and self-righteousness and really commitment to a narrow view of things. I'll give one example, actually. I was heading a program at Berkeley Law on mindfulness and law, which had a very positive impact on the students who were involved, and they were many. And it was beneficial for a number of faculty members. There were students who actually came to Berkeley Law School because they knew of this program and they wanted to be part of it. And then a new dean came to the law school, And for reasons that I still don't know, because he never spoke to me, he simply cut the legs out from under our program, made it impossible for me to stay on. I struggled to accept this because I could. At first, I tried to change his actions. several hundred students filed a petition that they wanted this program saved, but it just wasn't going to happen. And I first I tried to see him, but he wouldn't see me. But still, I tried to hold out to not blaming him, not understanding why he had done what he had done, but not to blame him and make him an evil person. And then for a variety of other reasons, his career at the law school was cut short, and he's no longer the dean. But the damage he did, in many respects, and certainly with respect to the mindfulness program at Berkeley Law, remains on. So, and a lot of my friends have encouraged me to just vent my anger about him and what he did. And I can't point to anything that I think it's better for me to have managed to view what he did as unfortunate, a real disservice to the education of law students at this law school. But he did what he did for whatever reasons he had. And it doesn't serve me or the law school community to let my anger toward him find its full expression. So unfortunately, it's not a happy story where mindfulness change somebody's mind, but it is promising in this sense that the fact that it makes it more likely, in my opinion, that a mindfulness program, a meditation program at the law school will revive sometime when it's appropriate, when the right people come together, and that by keeping the added unnecessary toxicity out of the atmosphere, I think that there is a small victory, and a basis for hope.
Well, thank you, Charlie, and thank you, Christy, for the question. I want to come back and ask both Mafia as well as for other folks who may have interest in following up coming out of this. We're coming upon the end of our time here, but is it okay, Charlie, if we offer ways to get in touch with you to ask you questions after the call?
Yes, absolutely. I'd be delighted. I have to warn the commenters and the inquirers that I'm rather slow in responding, but I would really welcome that conversation. And in particular, I really welcome this effort to take this work with lawyers and mindfulness global.
Well, thank you so much. We'll make sure that we follow up with that, and I'd love to turn it over to Alyssa for a recap.
Great. Thank you, Birju, and thank you, Charlie. I think this has been a really wonderful conversation, and as I mentioned before, I'm just really grateful to have been a part of it. I think there's so many aspects of this conversation that struck me, but one thing that I think really struck me, and as I'm thinking back on the conversation, I think it's very striking that the seeds for Charlie, for the wisdom path that Charlie went down, and the seeds for all the social activism that Charlie engaged in, really were sown at a very early age. We discussed in the earlier part of the conversation that the Holocaust, World War II, left a big imprint on Charlie's family and was a big part of Charlie's passion for social justice. So those seeds were formed very early and became a big part of his life. Similarly, Charlie had these amazing experiences out in nature, and he started having this kind of deep inner peace that gave him kind of an intimation of what's to come in terms of the wisdom path that he would eventually go down. And both of those things ended up becoming more and more prominent in his life as he transitioned from corporate law to public interest law and started pursuing social advocacy on a you know, on a much larger and more meaningful scale. And same with his time at CUNY and bringing it to the sphere of education as well. And we've been discussing in the latter part of the conversation how mindfulness has added a new and important dimension to his social advocacy work and has really imbued it with a new purpose. And according to Charlie, has made it much more effective. And so I'm really excited that where this conversation has led, and I'm really interested to hear more about how mindfulness can infuse all of our social work, all of our work in the world. So thank you again, Charlie, for this really wonderful conversation.
And Charlie, one thing we'd like to do in terms of ending our call together is practicing gratitude for the space and the offering that you have offered to us. I have one final question for you before we move there. Is there any suggestions that you have for those of us on the call who want to offer into your work? How can we do that?
Well, first of all, just connecting with me and telling me what your interests are and what kind of contributions you could make would be helpful. And I hope my email address will be made available to your listeners.
Yes.
And I'm currently, we're currently launching a group called Transforming Justice, the Center for Mindfulness and Criminal Justice. And you can look us up online and see what we're doing and what we hope to do. And anybody who connects with the goal of trying to make a criminal justice system that works for everybody, that where people's sense of safety and also sense of community and sense of individual responsibility and compassion and interconnection is fed and nourished. Anybody who has that interest could certainly connect with the work we're doing there. But I think the conversation and the encouragement that people could pursue their own practice, to do it in community, and to always find that point at which our inner work can really help to nourish the world is the best I can think of.
Well, thank you so much, Charlie. I'd love to invite everyone into 1 minute of practicing gratitude and hopefully carrying that forward through the rest of our day, after which I'll be taking everyone off of mute to share their gratitude with you. I'll call our attention in 1 minute. Thank you for joining. All right. So on the count of three, I will be taking everyone off of the Q&A protocol and unmuting all lines. And I'd love for us to share our gratitude. On the count of three, thank you, Charlie. One, two.
Thank you.
Thank you, Charlie.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you all. And can I add my expression? I just want to express my gratitude to Alyssa and to Birju and the whole service-based community for giving us all this lovely opportunity today.
Oh, thank you so much, Charlie. We are grateful to be able to play this role, and look forward to our awakening call next week. For those who can join, we have Marjorie Maddox joining us, talking about engaging with the world through poem and story. Thank you again for joining. Have a wonderful Saturday.
Thank you for listening to a recording of Awaken Calls. To access archives, visit us at www.awaken.org. And to get more involved, volunteer at www.servicespace.org.